Up next, to sort of take us into the legal weeds of the Muslim ban itself, I'd like to welcome Rachel Rosenblum. She's a professor of law at Northeastern University School of Law. She's also the co-director of the Immigrant Justice Clinic and teaches courses on immigration law, refugee and asylum law, and administrative law. Her scholarship focuses on the deportation system and the ways in which immigration enforcement increasingly intersects with criminal law. Prior to joining the faculty at Northeastern, Professor Rosenblum was a fellow at the Center for Human Rights and International Justice at Boston College, where she was the supervising attorney for the center's post-deportation human rights project. So please join me in welcoming Rachel.
Thank you so much. And I just really want to thank the organizers of this event. I'm happy to be at any event that focuses on resisting these policies, but this is a particularly good one. Really. Partly I'm happy to be here just because I happen to be a member of several of the organizations that are co-sponsored, so it's personally nice. But I feel like I have a background in history, and I usually kind of have to come in and say, these things have deep historical roots. And look, I don't have to do that at all now. You know, back to 14. I don't usually go back to 1492, but I think I will now. So, and certainly to 9/11. I mean, these, and to 1996. I mean, everything, every piece of anti-immigrant policy that you see in this country is building on layers and layers. All right, so I have a lot to tell you. Certainly, there's been in terms of anti-immigrant policies in the Trump administration. I'm going to talk about the Muslim ban, and I'm going to talk about refugees and DACA. And then I'm also going to talk briefly about TPS, temporary protected status, and sanctuary cities, since I think those really need to be on our radar as well. So, and some of this I'm sure you know already, but we've had several versions of the Muslim ban. We had the first version back in January, barring admission from 7 countries for 90 days, Iran, Iraq, Sudan, Syria, Somalia, Yemen, and Libya. It also had refugee provisions, but I'll talk about those next. So it was a complete ban. It had no nuance to it at all. It was clearly not drafted by lawyers. It was very broadly worded. It had no exceptions. It had no waivers. It had nothing. And it was very quickly struck down by the courts all around the country, including 2 courts that issued nationwide injunction. So it never really went into effect except for the chaotic first couple of days. So then while the litigation was going on around that, we got Muslim Ban 2.0 in March of last year. It dropped Iraq from the list. I know we had 6 countries, although Iraqis were subject to extra scrutiny. It tried to, superficially address some of the criticisms of the court. So it had exceptions in it, you know, for lawful permanent residents and for various other categories of people. It had a waiver provision. People could, you know, on a case-by-case basis, try to overcome this ban by showing special circumstances. But the courts were not convinced. They saw this, I think rightly so, as you know, just sort of window dressing, right? I was very heartened, I'd say, by the fact that the courts really understood that this was a Muslim ban, right? Even when there were many attempts to make it look like it wasn't, and we're frequently in the position of knowing that something is discriminatory, but having a hard time showing it. And I think it was, you know, we live in an odd era where, I mean, and like with, you know, special registration, there have been these issues for years, right, that seem so blatantly discriminatory. But it's so overt now, and, you know, there were all those campaign trail, you know, the statements on the campaign trail, and sort of like finally the judiciary got it. So they basically put a stop to the second version as well. And that litigation was working its way up. That ended up at the Supreme Court, and was the last June. The Supreme Court said the case would be heard this fall, and the Supreme Court did let the ban go partially into effect last June. They said they made this distinction between people who have significant ties to the United States, you know, close family members, etc., and people who were just sort of coming, you know, without those ties. But it was partially blocked. And so we thought we were going to have arguments on the ban this fall. And then we got a third version, right, in September, which has a different list of countries. We now have, so there's 8 countries on the September 24th version. It's Chad, Iran, Libya, North Korea, Syria, Venezuela, Somalia, and Yemen, although different, sort of in different versions for several different countries. So, for example, for Venezuela, it's just government officials. So there's some variation. And so the Supreme Court basically said, well, we're not going to hear those arguments on the old version because we now have this new policy. So this then, you know, started back in at the courts. And the courts more or less said what they keep saying, which is you can, you know, dress it up however you want, but we still think it's a Muslim ban. And there's basically, I should say, there's I have 2 arguments that have won some favor in the courts. One is a constitutional argument. That it's a distinction based on religion. The First Amendment says the government can't favor one religion over another. There's also a statutory argument, which is that the Immigration and Nationality Act, which is the big law that governs immigration, it contains a provision that says that the government can't discriminate on the basis of national origin when it comes to immigrant visas. That's a legacy of the 1965 Immigration Act, because prior to that, all we had were laws that discriminated on the basis of national origin, and in the midst of the Civil Rights Movement, we had the 1965 Act, and they put that provision in. So there's an argument that it violates that as well. So the lower courts have shown that they are very suspicious of the newest version of the Muslim ban, but as we all know, yesterday, the Supreme Court did say that the current version of the ban can go into effect pending, you know, while the litigation is going on. So I just want to clarify, the Supreme Court did not decide the case yesterday. What happened is that the lower courts had issued something called a preliminary injunction. They said, we have to figure out if this is legal or not, and we're going to not let it go into effect while we're figuring that out. And in fact, and that's what the district court said. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals had said, well, we'll let it partially go into effect while we're figuring this out. And then the Supreme Court said, we will let it fully go into effect. But as I said, that doesn't mean the Supreme Court's decided the case yet. What it means is it's going into effect while the courts are deciding it. I think it's still quite likely that the lower courts will reject these policies as they have all along. I have to say, though, that I didn't have much confidence in the Supreme Court before yesterday, and I certainly don't after their ruling yesterday. I think that, you know, they've signaled that they are going to uphold this policy. So I think we're going to see it get blocked in the lower courts, but we are going to see it go up to the Supreme Court. Obviously, it's just my speculation, but I am not too confident about that. Okay, so then that's where things are on this. It's grim. It's not over yet by any means, and I do think that there is, you know, there are some good decisions that are going to come out of the lower courts, but we will see where it goes. On refugees, so the original executive order also had a provision on refugee resettlement. It reduced by more than half the number of refugees who would be brought to the United States last fiscal year, and put an indefinite bar on Syrian refugees, and it froze all refugee admissions for 120 days. That was the original order. Let me just pause for a minute and clarify something, which is that there are people who apply for asylum in the United States, and then there are people who come to the United States from other countries as refugees with visas. It's the same legal standard. Both, you know, for either one, you have to show that you meet the definition of a refugee, someone who has a fear of persecution on account of race, religion, nationality, membership in a particular social group, or political opinion. But they're very, very different programs. And so all of these orders have had to do with the overseas program. which has always been a program where the executive branch, the president, and the Department of State have a lot of discretion. So there's millions of people who meet the definition of a refugee, but the United States has traditionally chosen 100,000 of them or so every year and said, here, you get a visa, and you get a visa. And there have always been limits, numerical limits, preferences of people from one country over another in that program. That's very different. In this, for someone who's actually already here, everyone has the right to apply for asylum, and there's no numerical limit. There's no limit on countries. The people who are in the asylum office, I happen to know a bunch of them. They're the same people who've been working there all along. Many of them come from advocacy backgrounds. We haven't seen the kind of huge changes that you see in DHS and in various parts of the Trump administration in the domestic asylum program. So when I say there's limits, I'm just talking about people being brought in here from overseas. But the limits are very, very troubling. So our numbers of refugees who are being admitted are far lower than they've been for many, many years. So it went from 110,000 to dropped to 50,000, and it's just been announced for the current fiscal year 18, the limit is supposedly 45,000, but they're letting in so few people that I doubt we'll even reach that. So basically, and it's similar, and the last time we saw this was right after 9/11, where there was a temporary freeze on refugee admissions. So the first version of the ban had total freeze on refugees for 120 days, indefinite freeze on Syrian refugees. The second version in March had total ban for 120 days, it dropped the Syrian part of the Syrian provision. And then just recently in September, the announcement was made that refugee admissions will be starting up again, but again with much lower numbers and with 11 countries subject to extreme scrutiny, and they won't say what countries they are, and it's a lot of speculation, but it's going to be a familiar set of countries. A lot of overlap with the Muslim ban countries. So things are very grim on the refugee resettlement front. But again, I just want to clarify, it does not affect the domestic asylum program, which is, every aspect of our government is being affected by the new administration, but I would say you see the changes less there than really anywhere else. So DACA, let me tell you where things are at with DACA. I'm sorry, I don't have good news on any front, so I'm just going to go from one bad news story to another. But so DACA is Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. It was a program created by the Obama administration in 2012 because Congress had failed to pass the DREAM Act. The DREAM Act would have given green cards and a path to citizenship to undocumented immigrants who came here as children. That failed in Congress, and so then after being pressured a lot by young undocumented immigrants who did a lot of activism, a lot of civil disobedience, Obama came out with the DACA program. About 800,000 people have benefited from it. It does not provide a visa. Only Congress can do that, but it provides people with work authorization, 2 years' worth of work authorization, and protection from deportation. So it's been very, very significant. People at this point have gotten it and gotten it renewed, and so have had several years of being able to study or work. And so in 2014, the Obama administration tried to greatly expand DACA, both to expand the actual DACA program and to add another program called DAPA, which was for parents, undocumented parents who had kids who are citizens or permanent residents. That potentially would have reached about 5 million people, and that was blocked in the courts. You might remember a bunch of Republican governors and attorney generals went to court and blocked it on these very kind of technical administrative law arguments that it wasn't promulgated in the right way. So the expansion never went into effect, but the original program did, and as I said, it has benefited a lot of people. And so on September 5th, the Trump administration announced the end of the DACA program. They immediately stopped taking new applications, and they said that people who had renewals basically up people whose status was going to expire between now and March could apply by October to extend that. So at this point, that the period for renewals is over. Some people will have another couple of years, but we're going to start to see these expirations very soon, and we're going to see a lot of young people who have had status now and going back to being undocumented. That doesn't mean they will necessarily be deported right away, but they will be vulnerable to deportation and they will lose their work authorization. Next, I want to just give you an update about temporary protected status, which is similar to DACA in certain ways. It's also a status that doesn't give people a path to citizenship, it doesn't give people a visa, but it gives people some measure of security, a couple of years of a work authorization and protection from deportation. There's a number of countries that have been designated over the years for TPS. Because civil wars are going on or natural disasters or something of that sort. And so it's called temporary, but really, in fact, it's not temporary. These have tended to be extended over the years, and people have just kind of, put down roots and become part of communities. But now we're starting to see the end of TPS. So the Trump administration has announced the end of TPS for Haitians. There's about 59,000 Haitians who are affected by this. It will expire soon. TPS has been ended for Nicaraguans. And then the biggest group is Salvadorans. There's about 200,000 people from El Salvador who have TPS. And no announcement has been made yet, but everybody is very nervous about that. So I think we may see that soon. Okay, the final issue I wanted to tackle is just the changes to, as you all know, I'm sure, there has been a surge of interior enforcement and a resurgence of using the criminal justice system as a funnel. I mean, this has been going on since the 90s, really since the late 80s, this way that the criminal justice, we now call this crimmigration, this kind of system that knits together the criminal law enforcement. And, in an age of mass incarceration and broken windows policing, we know how many people get funneled through the criminal justice system. And when you connect that to the deportation system, you're getting huge influx of people into that system. So we have a lot of, maybe get a little bit of the good news. We have a lot of, on the level of cities, we see a lot of resistance to this, right? And we see a lot of sanctuary city policies, and including right here in Cambridge and Boston as well, and a lot of communities around here. No city can really protect people completely from immigration enforcement. If ICE wants to come in and do a raid in Cambridge, it is able to do so. But what cities can do is to refuse to cooperate. And frankly, you can't really run a system of mass deportation unless the police are involved. If you look at the numbers, there's a small number much larger than it used to be, but a relatively small number of ICE agents and a huge number of local police. And there's been an attempt to kind of harness those local police for years. And so you really can do a lot at the local level to kind of stop that system. And so the Trump administration has been threatening since he came into power, he's been threatening sanctuary cities in various ways, including pulling federal funding from sanctuary cities. So one way that, one form of retaliation that I think we're seeing and is very troubling is the use of, ICE doing raids in sanctuary cities, clearly as retaliation for their policies. But in terms of all of the other threats, like pulling the funding, the government's argument really doesn't have a leg to stand on, and the courts have in the last few months really stepped in and made it clear that they think it's completely unconstitutional for the federal government to try to control what local governments do. So there is this, I think if we're looking for the bright spot of where to put our energies, go local would be my closing thought to you. And then the one other thing I just want to say, and I think I really feel like it's been said here before, so I don't need to say it too much, but how connected these issues are. I've seen over the years in immigrant rights work all the lines that can kind of get drawn between good immigrants and bad immigrants in various different ways. and how important it is to see these disparate, you know, seemingly disparate issues as really part of the same system. So, thank you.